This session is on the preferential option for the poor. What do the Roman Catholic bishops mean? Now, since I can't assume that the same people are here that were here yesterday, let me take a few minutes and talk a little bit about the background of the bishop's letter, and then we'll move directly into a discussion of the preferential option for the poor. A number of church bodies have produced statements in recent years having to do with questions of economic justice. The Presbyterians have one, the Lutherans have one, the United Church of Christ has one. The Canadian bishops produced one several years ago, actually before the U.S. Catholic bishops did. But the letter, or the document that's gotten the most attention publicly, has been that produced by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. There was a committee of five bishops formed in 1981 that was chaired by Archbishop Weakland of Milwaukee. And between 81 and 84, this committee held a series of hearings in which they invited people from a number of different persuasions and occupations and expertise to come and testify before the committee. And the first draft appeared in 1984, 1 week after Reagan was reelected. They intentionally held it until 1 week after the election because they didn't want it to be seen as a partisan document. Now, essentially what the bishops call for is a new set of criteria by which we evaluate an economic order. Typically, if you pick up a sophomore economics textbook and sort of read the introduction, there will usually be something in there on criteria for judging an economic order. And usually words like efficiency, growth, if it's written in a capitalist context, usually freedom will be one of the criteria by which you judge an economic order. Some more recent textbooks have things like conservation of resources and but the bishops want to go a good bit further than that, and the bishops want to say that there are some ethical criteria that we should use when we make judgments about an economic order. And so after a very fine discussion of certain biblical themes and passages, they come up with what they call an understanding of justice as participation. Justice as participation. And it includes a recognition of the essential dignity of every human being. The bishops want to say that the Judeo-Christian understanding of human beings created in the image of God means that one's worth does not depend, in the first instance, upon one's capacity as a producer or a consumer. That simply as a child of God, one has worth. And therefore, an economic order ought to take note of that. There ought to be an element of grace in defining what we mean by justice. Now, a second point in the bishop's notion of justice as participation is the claim that human beings are essentially social, by which they mean that one cannot be a complete human being without a relationship to one's fellow human beings. Now, when they talk about community, they make it clear they want to go beyond the idea of a group that is based simply upon mutual self-interest. In other words, people come together sometimes simply because I have something you want and you have something I want, and we have a kind of mutual exchange. What the bishops want to say is that there is a dimension of community that is really deeper than that. Love goes beyond simply mutual self-interest. And so they recognize that simply changing economic structures and policies in order won't guarantee that we're going to love each other like that. But the claim is that there are some structures and some policies and some ways of organizing our economy that will encourage that kind of community more than others. Now, the third element in this notion of justice as participation is what the bishops call the preferential option for the poor and the marginalized. Now, the reason this takes such an important perspective for the bishops is that it is precisely the poor and the marginalized who are kind of on the fringes of society. And these are the people that we need to pay some attention to as a way of the society, the community, reaching out and including them. And so when they talk about the preferential option for the poor, what the bishops want to say is that we should try to develop certain strategies that will enable these people to feel accepted in the community and will enable them to participate. When the bishops talk about justice, they make it clear that justice includes not only an acceptance of others, but one also has an obligation to participate. And we cannot, of course, force anybody to participate, but that we need to be sensitive to those areas in our economy that discourage participation and make it virtually impossible for some people to be full participants in the economic order. Well, with that as a kind of background then, let's the bishops have a long discussion of poverty, and which relates very directly to this idea of the preferential option for the poor. Now, what I've done here is sort of put up some questions and that we can talk about, and I'll kind of do a running commentary sort of on what the bishops are saying. Let me say this, that the bishops do not claim that they are experts in economic matters, and they acknowledge that the kind of policy statements that they make are open to debate. Now, they do claim a little more authority for the biblical and ethical sections of the letter. They don't think there can be quite as much differences of opinion about that, but they are certainly open to debate and discussion about policy matters. And so I think their hope is that the letter will indeed engender a kind of public debate. What kind of strategies can we devise for recognizing more fully the dignity of the individual, for encouraging human community, and for bringing the poor and the marginalized into full participation into our group? So that's a way of saying that, I hope this will evoke not just a kind of knee-jerk agreement or something, but a capacity, an interest in real dialogue. Now, one of the questions when we start dealing with poverty is, who are the poor? Do you know how the government arrives at its official definition of poverty? You know, we talk about the poverty line. Do you know what the exact figures are right now? What for a family of let's see, I've got it written down here. For a family of four, what is the current poverty line?
$15,000 a year.
It's about $11,000. Now these figures come are about a year old. These are from 1985, and I suppose the 86 figures are out. I just haven't gone to get them, but. It was right at $11,000 for 85 for a family of four. For one person, it was about $5,500. Now, the way the government arrives at this is based upon a practice that began in the 1960s, in which economists discovered that poorer families spent about one-third of their income on food. About one-third of their income on food. And so what they did was to develop what they called a thrifty food budget. They went out and went to the supermarket and, you know, what would be the least that a family would have to spend to buy food that would provide the basic minerals and vitamins and nutrients that people needed. And so they took the cost of this thrifty food budget and multiplied it by three. And that became the poverty line. Now, it's adjusted every year for inflation because prices tend to go up. And so the poverty line is always three times the thrifty food budget. It's based on a kind of average. You're exactly right here that the poverty line in Mississippi may not exactly be what it may be in Hartford, Connecticut, or something. But it's based on a kind of average, and then you know you each kind of region of the country might. Now the recent changes in the tax law have improved that to some extent. In other words, it has taken a lot of the people who were under the you're right. I mean, as the government has cut, the federal government has cut back on revenue sharing, then the local and state taxes, which tend to be very regressive taxes, have almost eaten a lot of that out. Exactly right. There was a time when we talked about a culture of poverty, and let me just read something to you here without initial comment. And then I want you, let's talk about it a little bit. The basic question here is, who are the poor? And we can define them in terms of the government's official line. But here is a kind of case study of a particular family. It focuses on a woman that is pseudonymously called here Willie Mae Smith. Willie Mae comes from a highly disorganized family milieu. Her father, Buck, was pathologically unstable. He drank too much and was a skirt chaser and gambler. When he went broke during the Depression, his father-in-law had to bail him out, paying Buck's rent on condition that he straighten up. Unable to do so, Buck began fighting with Mary Ann, Willie Mae's mother. The couple separated and then began to compete for the affections of their children. Buck initially won out. He visited his daughters often. Willie Mae had a younger sister named Laura. He visited his daughters often, spoiled them shamelessly, and taught them his philosophy of playing hard to get to attract men. Mary Ann's remarriage was a blow to him. The originally extroverted Buck became tuned out. He drank heavily. Willie Mae, in the words of one observer, was emotionally scarred by the events of her family situation. As a young woman, she held a job briefly and then married Roosevelt, a man much like her father with a reputation for sexual promiscuity. He, too, came from a family prone to violence and tragedy. Three siblings died violently. One was divorced. One was mentally retarded. And another's wife had psychiatric problems. A married brother had been implicated in the drowning death of a girlfriend, but the police were never able to pin anything on him. More than 20 years passed before Willie Mae got another job. The first one had been fun, she said much later, but toward the end I got tired. It taught me not to expect too much and not to take things for granted. The marriage lasted 10 years, much longer than one might have expected, given Roosevelt's sexual adventures. Willie Mae's compulsive spending on clothes and baubles for herself, and the fights that resulted, it was a decade punctuated by family crises. Her father, a pathetic drunk, finally died. Her sister Laura divorced and remarried after having a relationship with Jimmy, an older man whom Willie Mae was later to marry herself. Willie Mae conceived 5 children by Roosevelt, only 2 of whom are alive today. They were largely reared by others. Willie Mae's marriage ended abruptly when Roosevelt was shot to death on the street by a man who was thought to be deranged. She remained single for a while, but because of her looks and her image as a man's woman, she had no lack of male attention. One person described her as attracting men like honey does bees. Her second husband was Jimmy, a divorced man whose scrapes with the law seemed to contribute to his sex appeal. Willie Mae had known him before Roosevelt's death. Rumor had it that her sister Laura had slept with Jimmy before Laura's first marriage broke up, and then again after she remarried. Jimmy had seen Willie Mae soon after Roosevelt was killed, and their relationship continued until their marriage, which was said to have infuriated Jimmy's long-term girlfriend, as well as a number of his more casual ones. As Jimmy's wife, Willie Mae continued her life as a party girl, sometimes with Jimmy, sometimes without. She stayed up till dawn painting the town. As this case history was being written in early 1974, there were signs that their marriage was on the rocks. They fought often. Jimmy's daughter, by a previous marriage, was said to hate Willie Mae, and this seemed to be dampening Jimmy's ardor for his wife. To sum up, Willie Mae's lifestyle exemplifies the characteristics of the culture of poverty. She has an aversion to work, even though she could get a job. She hates housework and childcare. Her life has a random quality to it, as Willie Mae has no disciplined commitment to a life goal. She is the paradigm of the present time-oriented individual, sometimes justifying this by the pain and suffering she has endured. She compulsively spends money on clothes and adornments. Her kin networks are remarkable for their pathology, the involvement of their members in violence, drugs, divorce, illicit sex. The families tend to be large, and internal tensions often lead to deviance. Add to this a penchant for high living, the dog which is exhibited in the men, the pursuit of sex and alcohol and late night adventure, and you have precisely that admixture of impulsiveness and irresponsibility that epitomizes a lower class culture. What do you make of that?
Sounds like
government propaganda.
What?
Government propaganda.
Government propaganda. Why do you say it's propaganda?
Well, I think it's taking, surely there are people that fit that general mold, but it's taking a specific and generalizing to a whole class of people.
Okay.
I know some people who are not very well off. They work their you-know-what stuff to try to make ends meet, and they don't do anything.
Okay. Well, what, all right,
I'm really curious about the author of that, you know, because it isn't sociological jargon. It's another kind of jargon that's just loaded with value statements and judgments.
Okay.
I mean, even down to so-and-so like
okay.
my baubles. And,
okay.
You know, so okay. I can't give it a handle on, you know,
okay.
who's authored this and for what purpose.
Okay. I'll tell you in a minute. Now, when you say it's propaganda, who would this benefit?
It would benefit people who benefit from the status quo. I guess that would be. Well, I don't know who that would be, but I'm sure there are people who benefit
okay.
from.
Okay. There was somebody over here, Heather. Meredith?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, if you change the names and a few other things, it also could be a plot or a soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But, you know, because of the names and because of certain things, you immediately assume it's, you know, a low-class, black,
okay.
Pathetic.
All right, the names Willie Mae and Buck and Jimmy.
The other thing that interests me, though, and it's like so many things, is if this is discussing the poor, most of us, I think, when we hear poor, we think in terms of lack of money.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't really discussed in that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for American poor especially, though, it's an interesting topic to get into, which is yours, who are the poor, especially in
okay.
America, because it certainly isn't just a lack of money type situation.
Okay.
This
right.
may sound very strange, and it really opens up something I don't discuss a great deal, but that sounds an awfully lot like the letter that my son wrote me about a woman that he had fallen in love with and has married, and they're getting along very well,
mm-hmm.
but it sounds like her family background to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it does happen.
I think in a certain way it perpetuates also a way of looking at people's experience.
Mm-hmm.
Keeps them at a distance.
Okay, and if you, I think there is a kind of mythology of poverty in this country, that the poor are shiftless, that they are promiscuous. And this can become a part of an ideology then that almost enables us to distance ourselves and say, well, look, if you're going to be like that, you deserve to be poor. Right here.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say is, like, I now teach upper economic children, and they lack compassion for the poor because they've never been there, and the attitude I hear, which is similar to this, the covert message there is that it's by choice,
mm-hmm.
because of their decisions and their lifestyle and this kind of thing, and that's the kind of thing I hear in my kids. Whereas from my own experiences in other situations, it seems like, you break down alongside a road, the people that come by and offer to help are the people who work in down cars, the people that can identify with
mm-hmm.
your plight, you know, and the Oldsmobiles and Lincolns drive right by.
Wow.
So these kids just don't have the sense of being, and I'm sure they get that message from some place.
Yeah. Okay. Did you have
the one bit of truth I saw in that, though, I think is that it talked about is the family systems.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that poverty begets poverty. That there's that a lot of the upbringing or kind of keeps that going, can
mm-hmm.
keep the fuel
yeah.
back and keep the whole thing running at the same pace. It's
okay.
great that you have to somehow get in there at a very early age and start the whole thing, because the whole mentality develops. Really on. I think there's some
okay.
truth in that.
All right. So in other words, that Part of the truth may be that there can be a kind of culture of poverty that sort of perpetuates itself. Right back here.
Okay. I was going to agree with that, but I'm not sure how much of it is attitude and how much of it is situation.
Okay.
I mean, if you're at the bottom and if the culture of the society doesn't give you any sort of chance to climb up, mm-hmm. so to speak, then you're something. And I think that our society is moving toward that sort of stratification. Okay.
This piece was written by someone who was attacking the kind of stereotype of the culture of poverty as a culture of shiftlessness. And she is a sociologist, and let me read the next paragraph. Willie May is the fictitious name of a well-known person. But aside from having altered her name and those of the other principals, I have taken no liberties in the above case history with any of the known facts or published rumors about the life of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. That is, I have taken no liberties except the ones most commonly taken in sociological accounts of the poor. I have selected the facts to suit a predetermined interpretation of an individual, and I have used some loaded words to describe them. Students of poverty, going a step further, have built a one-sided case against an entire social class, the poor. The ideology of poverty influences the way a sociologist sees and describes the poor, even though the researcher is often unaware of it. But whether he is aware or not, his description serves the interest of the affluent by justifying the present inequitable distribution of wealth and income. Now see, what she's trying to get at is that we have built, my guess is that those of us here are much more aware that the stereotype is not true, but the students I teach, this is their perception of the poor. Maybe this is a little exaggerated, but we have this kind of idea of who the poor are, and then we sort of project these attitudes and all the fun. Well, now, who are the poor, really? Let's
according to that, then obviously the people with too much money.
Yeah, too much money. That's one of the things the bishops want to say is that even though they talk about a preferential option for the poor, the flip side of that is that the wealthy who are not materially or physically poor, are in danger of losing their humanity in the sense that community is disrupted and all. Who are the poor? Are most poor, most of our poor, black or white?
Americans are white.
Okay, about two-thirds are white, and if you go strictly by the number.
But if it's percentage of their group.
Okay, if it's percentage of their group, then you've got, for example, I need a little bigger board here, but for example, black people constitute about 12% of our population. But, I think they, let's see, I'm getting my figures. Sixty-2% of the long-term poor are black. So you've got, they're 12% of the population, but 62%, this is for black, poor, long-term poor. We'll talk about the difference in the long-term and the short-term.
62% of their group, or of that 200% of the whole group?
62% of the long-term poor are black.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would make Team America more blacks than whites in the long term.
Wait a minute. You're right. These numbers don't match up, do they? Wait a minute. That may be 62% of...
Of the
12%.
That's too high.
That's too high for them.
I think Well, but 62% of the long-term poor could be what percentage of the poor are long-term poor.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a much smaller number, but 62%.
Please just make
it yourself. I'm embarrassed here. Wait a minute. I'm usually pretty good with numbers.
What
other categories are there? For example, in terms of children under 6 in the United States, 25% of all children under 6 live in a household that's classified as poor. I think it's 50% of all black children under 6 live in a household that's officially classified as poor. And when you come to black children in a female-headed household, it jumps from 50% to 67%. And for Hispanic children in a female-headed household, 75% of Hispanic children under 6 would be classified as poor. I'm still not sure what to do with that.
You could give us a report tomorrow.
Yeah, I don't know. In 1985, 14% of the U.S. population was below the poverty line, and this included 33.1 million people.
John, do you have any indications in your materials you have with you about Native Americans?
I don't have any figures for that, but they are, I think those figures may be even more destitute than those for blacks.
Yeah, on the reservations, I think it's somewhere around 80 to 85% unemployed.
Yeah, 80 to 85%. Yeah, mm-hmm. Unemployed.
Yeah.
Mm. Now the unemployment among blacks, you know, would run significantly higher than that among whites. And you get the black teenagers, it's about 30%, but nothing like 80%. Well, I will try to check on these figures. At Furman, I team teacher course with an economist. So I wish she were here to straighten out. Take some of the blame, that's right. It must be. Well, I'll try to go over these and. Let's see, but the point here is that you have, even though numerically, there are more white people who are poor than blacks or Hispanics, the percentage of those in poverty is considerably higher among blacks and Hispanics, and particularly female-headed households. And you have no doubt read about the problems with female-headed households. For one thing, the typical woman who is working at a full-time job earns a salary only 61% of that of a man. And Ann and I have some personal experience of discrimination because we filed an affirmative action complaint when we made some discoveries about her salary. And it took us a while, but we won. But there were some horrendous costs involved because one of the principals responsible was still there, and he gave Anne hell after she won the case. Even though, I mean, our discrimination that Anne experienced was not in any way in terms of a kind of destitute situation, still, it was, when we discovered what was happening, it made us angry. All of this. But the typical woman's wage is only 61% of that of the man. A recent study on custody practices in the United States has revealed some very interesting kinds of things. That in the 19th century, the man was almost always granted custody of the children in a divorce case. And in the 19th century, children were still an economic benefit because of agrarian practices. And with the changes from an agrarian to a more industrial economy, children became more and more a financial liability. And in that transition, custody began to shift from the man to the woman. And this was done by a young woman at the University of Massachusetts. It's a very interesting article about, which is a kind of patriarchy that is often hidden from us. Now, I have this question up there. Do we really want to end poverty, or who benefits from poverty? There have been some interesting things published that, in fact, particularly those of us who are relatively affluent, we benefit in some subtle ways from poverty. If there are always some people poor at the bottom, this tends to depress wages. And you always have people who are willing to do the kind of dirty jobs, like collect the garbage and things like this. But I want to move on to some other points here. The bishops, in talking about the preferential option for the poor, the bishops say that if we lived in a society where everybody was relatively poor, then maybe we couldn't do much about the poverty. But the bishops make the statement that because of the great disparities of wealth in our country, that it's immoral not to address the problem in a very direct way. And they give a few statistics about the way income and wealth are distributed in our country. Now, the differences in income and wealth? Income is simply the money that you would make and report on your income tax form in a given year. You know, your income, which would include your salary or wages, or you have stock, your dividends, or interest on a savings account or something. Whereas wealth has to do with your net worth. Now, if you go to buy a house, they'll do a little sheet there where they calculate your net worth. Now, here's some kind of basic figures. If you divide the United States population basically into fifths, say the bottom 20% and then the next 20%, in terms of income, the bottom 20% of the population earns about 4.7% of the total income, whereas the top 20% earns 42.9% of the annual income. Those are figures for 1985. Now, in 1985, The bottom 20% had an income less than $13,500. The middle fifth had an income of $27,735. And then the top 20% had an income over $48,000. If you break this down in terms of white, black, and female-headed household, the typical white family, the median income, now median is a little different from average, but you know, if you put them all and you count down to the very middle one, the median income for a white family was $29,000 plus. This would be a household income. For a black family, it was $17,000. And for a home headed by a woman, it would be about $13,000. The median income for a college graduate would be $46,000. Now, when you get to the distribution of wealth, the discrepancies are even more striking. The top, if you talk about the really super rich, now, when we talk about wealth here, we're talking about not just homes and automobiles, but in terms of stocks and all this kind of work. But the top 0.5% of the population, you know, 1/200, the super rich, control 27% of the wealth in this country. And they would have a net worth of over $2.5 million each. The bottom 90%, in fact, if you take the top 10%, the wealthiest 10% of the U.S. population, controls 65% of all the wealth. You've got 10% of the people that control 65% of you know, their personal wealth as well as capital goods. And so the bottom 90% together controls about 35%. And so the bishops are saying that, you know, in light of this great discrepancy in the distribution of income and wealth, that it's really immoral not to to try to develop strategies to relieve. I don't have the figures broken down like that. I'm virtually sure that a white female-headed household would be higher than that of the black female-headed household, because when you begin to put together the female and the minority, you know, the median is always going to be down. But I don't know. Yeah. Lots of what?
Widows?
Yeah. Although, you know, increasingly the poverty rolls, the elderly are kind of getting off the poverty roll. Partly because of Social Security. And so the real onus of poverty now is in your young mother, who is probably more likely divorced than widowed, but is, you know, has responsibility for children.
It looks like to me, I read a time a year or two ago, somebody arguing that point,
mm-hmm.
arguing against that view, that the official line is, yes, the elderly are becoming
mm-hmm.
better off,
yeah.
but this article in Time magazine claimed that really...
Wait, wasn't you? Well, that may be. I mean, I'm sure there are still plenty of elderly poor, but... you have a lot of very wealthy elderly too that you know, have the Social Security as well as pensions and what about some of the non-material dimensions of poverty? One of the points the bishops make is that we can't simply define poverty simply in material terms. In other words, a part of the of not having the material necessities is often, you know, lack of opportunities to really fulfill one's you know, what one. Okay, yeah, very, very little opportunity for any kind of enrichment or anything like that.
The attitude of oneself.
Yeah, people who are very poor tend to suffer from loss of self-esteem. Meredith?
I think in our country, the fact that the poor can see so easily the rich, and then coupled with the fact that in our country we don't have a built-in class system, so they still feel that perhaps they're entitled to have a better life. What you see on TV, those kinds of things make their plight so much more obvious to them, I think. Mm-hmm. It creates a lot of feelings of problems.
Okay. In other words, that they have a lot of frustrated kind of desires, and when these cannot be fulfilled, they often become very cynical. It's interesting. You said that that the rich are quite visible to the poor, and yet the other side of that is that the poor are almost invisible to us. It's partly a kind of unconsciously willed on our part. I mean, we don't see them because we don't want to see them. But where Ann and I come from, most of the poor are rural poor. And we live right at the edge of the mountains, and a lot of Appalachian families. That's where the poverty is more than in a kind of urban ghetto, which you will not have in a big city.
It was an interesting and shocking experience to me recently. I went to school at the University of California, Berkeley, and I returned earlier this summer on a business trip. And going down to Oakland Airport, the airport that I took went through a poorer section of Oakland, California, which in four years of living in the Bay Area, I had never been to it. Mm-hmm. And I was just shocked the place just looked, well, it wasn't it could have been worse. It wasn't like a bombed out city or anything, but it was just obviously so depressed economically. I come from a lower middle class family. I had the good fortune to be able to go to college.
Yeah.
And in 4 years of college, I had never been in that place.
Never been there.
It was a shock.
Yeah.
The poor are much more subject to disease and a much higher child mortality rate. There is a much higher use of drugs. They are preyed on for theft and other violent crimes to a much higher degree.
Right.
So there's all sorts of things going on around them.
One of the debates in South Carolina right now, it has to do with whether we should institute a state lottery. And the studies that I have argued consistently against it, because the practice, I mean, the kind of reality in other states is that the poor are sort of disproportionately represented in those who play the lottery, and on the kind of dream of striking $1 million, and this is a way of pulling themselves out, but it. It tends to draw money from the people who can kind of least afford to play that. What about the welfare system? Does welfare, the bishops take a kind of it has and it hasn't attitude toward welfare. There's a recent study done at the University of Michigan by a guy named G.J. Duncan and others called Years of Poverty, Years of Plenty. And this study focused on 5,000 American families over a 10-year period. And it made some interesting discoveries that over a 10-year period, and with a sample of 5,000, you've got a fairly good sample there. That over a 10-year period, 25% of these families were on some kind of welfare program for at least a year or more. but only 1% were on welfare programs for the entire 10-year period. Now, the Charles Murray, George Gilter, Michael Novak faction, the people who have been kind of some of the architects of Reagan's social program, have argued that the Duncan study shows that things are not nearly as bad as the bishops say they are. The bishops, however, draw a different lesson from this and say that, you know, this provides some evidence that many people, I mean 25%, as a result of a sudden loss of a job, a divorce, or some kind of illness that throws the family in crisis, that that, you know, 25% have to depend upon this at some time, but that the welfare system is sufficient to enable them to get back on their feet so that they're, you know, not on the welfare system very long. So, you know, you have the same data here, and you have very different ways of looking about it. So, Gilder and Murray say this is evidence we can begin to do away with the social programs, as the bishops find another lesson.
Dan Myers, the staff bishop.
That's right. Okay, right. And the bottom category here. Well, some of the things that the bishops propose, the they argue that the first line of defense against poverty is a healthy economy that will provide employment opportunities at just wages for all adults who are able to work. And tomorrow I want to talk a little bit about modern work and human meaning and what the bishops do with that and what some others are doing. They want to reevaluate the tax system in terms of its impact on the poor. They're particularly concerned with things that will enable the poor to help themselves, and are critical, as you know, as you suggested, that sometimes welfare programs can be administered in such a way that the people become dependent upon them. And so can we sort of redesign these so that they will in fact assist the poor in becoming self-sufficient. And are trying to find ways that would reduce the stigma of using food stamps or being on an AFDC program, which is aid to families with dependent children. Look, our time is up, and one thing's neat about teaching here is I don't feel like I have to cover everything to get you ready for the final exam. So,
put it this way, you cover 62% of the material.
I cover 62% of the material. I got to go find it.